American Social History Podcasts are a production of the American Social History Project, Center for Media and Learning at the City University of New York Graduate Center. This talk was given at the Graduate Center.
My name is Josh Brown, and I'm the Executive Director of the American Social History Project Center for Media and Learning and a member of the history faculty here at the Graduate Center. I'm pleased to welcome you this evening to the first program in a series of three public panels called Still Hazy After All These Years, marking the sesquicentennial of the start of the American Civil War. Tonight's panel is entitled, Did the Real War Ever Get in the Books? Each member of our panel of distinguished historians has, one way or another, grappled with what has been included, excluded, overlooked, misinterpreted, and distorted in the record of the war. They will discuss their respective efforts to get the real war in the books and what they think has changed in the recent study of the Civil War, for better or for worse. Does anybody have any energy to address one another's points? I have questions, but I thought I'd give you a chance to.
Well, I think that I think anything that disturbs this sort of what has become almost a truism of the literature, you know, of the understanding of the Civil War, that a war for union becomes a war for emancipation, you know, you have to get behind that proposition. But I will say that I think it's interesting that every version of Lincoln that we get a more radical Lincoln. And I'm dubious. And I also think it's interesting that this is what sells. That the industry of Lincoln, the Civil War industry of Lincoln, is so overwhelming that, you know, the idea that every time we rewrite Lincoln, we get a better Lincoln, one that suits us better, I have to say I'm really dubious. I think it's a market-driven, possibly a market-driven, I think there's a... It's like when the literary critics worked on Harriet Beecher Stowe. In every generation, she got more and more radical. For example, on the question of the 13th Amendment, I think why are we not considering the obvious explanation, which is what Lincoln said, that he thought that the constitutionality of the Emancipation Proclamation would be challenged because of the exercise of war powers, and therefore he didn't want to leave it on that basis. He felt that he had to push through a constitutional amendment because he was afraid the Supreme Court would overturn it in the aftermath of the war and that would create chaos. So that's not an adequate explanation for why Lincoln pushed for the 13th Amendment. In other words, I'm all for shaking everything up, but I don't...
No, I don't think that's an adequate explanation for the 13th. I think I don't think that's an adequate explanation. I think it's one of the explanations. I actually think from early 1862 onward, this is the Congressional Globe that I've been reading, Democrats and border state congressmen started saying in the debates over emancipation, go ahead, emancipate the slaves, do what you want, but at some point this war is going to be over, and then the states are going to have their power to return to them, and they're just going to re-enslave the blacks. And they're going to enslave the free blacks along the way. And I don't see how you're going to get around that. That was their argument. And I don't think it was as much a concern that they were going to go, somebody was going to sue to the Supreme Court. I think it was afraid that if, in the absence of a constitutional amendment, state-based emancipations aren't adequate. That's one thing. And the other thing is, a debate erupts, and it's not a debate, you start to see discussions appearing in among Republicans in the press in late 1862, and it continues, to the effect that, you know, we thought when this war started that all the slaves would run to Union lines in huge, gigantic numbers. Now, there's lots of reasons why they might not have been able to, why the Confederacy was able to stop that from happening, but they become very conscious of that, and that consciousness of the inadequacy of emancipation, that they are not going to be able to change enough of the facts on the ground. That, I think, is much more important to Lincoln and the Republicans when they come to pushing for the Emancipation for the 13th Amendment, plus the threat that a state can re-enslave, than a simple constitutional issue. It's a recognition of the inadequacy of their original conceptions of emancipation. It doesn't make... whether Lincoln's a radical or not radical, one of the things that's curious about what I'm working toward is that I'm trying to say that Lincoln is a Republican. Whether the Republicans, I do think the Republicans are more radical than we've realized and been willing to say for the last 20 or 30 years, I think. But the problem with Lincoln scholarship is that it makes him stand out from what all the Republicans are doing, when it looks to me like the Republicans are divided on absolutely everything except emancipation from the beginning of the war through.
Any other thoughts, at least in terms of what you all were discussing before I raise some questions? Okay, I will. One that I was struck by when Stephanie was speaking was the question that you had raised about the Northern society and in relationship to the emphasis on Union history. And I guess this takes me back to my graduate education, and the Civil War is basically being this, and Herb Gutman, who started the Social History Project, was certainly an example of this, that the Civil War is this messy thing that sort of screws up working class history. That you've got before the Civil War working class history and after the Civil War. And to some extent, I'd like to raise the notion and question, has there been an attempt, there certainly have been some historiographies of working class history during the Civil War in the North, but what do you think there's any trend toward that?
That's an interesting question. What do you think?
I wouldn't see any trend. I do think that one thing that's sort of apparently available, and that you see, available on its face, and that you see aspects of, but that comes from a definitional question of what counts as working class history and what counts as military history, right? There are 2.1 million Union soldiers who are all employed on a wage basis, right? There's 900,000 Confederate soldiers. Sometimes the wages that they're getting are money that's vapor, but they're all employed on a wage. So you're talking about 3 million wage workers, in this four-year period. And that, in some sense, I wonder if the working class historians ceded that to the military historians, and the military historians weren't concerned with those kind of questions. But that it strikes me on those grounds that there's all kinds of ways, if we don't have to bracket the home front as the only real workers, that there's all kinds of ways in which that we can think about what these military forces are doing to the way that work is going to be redefined, to the way that this is going to spill outward into what these 3 million people, or the 2.4 million of them who aren't dead, do when they come out of the war. That this is a transformative experience of people who have either worked, many of which North and South have either worked on farms, either worked for, impressed labor for their family, which is romanticized by people who didn't do it, or for, kinds of barter or a sort of meager exchange, to where they're put in a scenario. And it strikes me from my reading of how much of the soldiers' correspondence is unsurprisingly about exactly that. Where's, Will Hickox, who's here, did a very strong paper on, the sort of amount of time that soldiers spend writing about their bounties. That we have a sort of hyper politicized, in some ways, sense of these soldiers. But as workers, it's not surprising that when they found out that somebody who volunteered 2 weeks later got a $600 bounty instead of a $300 bounty, that's a big deal. And a great deal of their interaction with the military proceeds upon their level of complaint. And as they realize the military is not going to be able or willing to respond to all these things, it immediately turns toward politics. And so it also strikes me how much, when you look especially at these people like Nathaniel Banks, Ben Butler, who both return, are immediately elected from Union generalship, immediately elected to Congress from Massachusetts, the whole terms of their correspondence is people writing to complain about this stuff. It takes a long time before we get to the policy, so letters about policy. They're just flooded with people saying, I want my $300. And in fact, these congressmen march into Congress. They're not dummies. There's 2.1 million Union soldiers, you know, the ones who survived were all enfranchised. They're not dummies. They immediately, the first sessions after the war, spent trying to rework the terms of this labor negotiation. But like I say, it's something that military historians don't think of in those terms, and working class historians don't see the military as what it is, in part, among other things, as a great labor force.
Well, one of the things that I would say about that, too, is, I mean, the old model was, you know, slavery to wage labor, right? So that was one paradigm of understanding the transition from slavery to freedom was slavery to wage labor. But, of course, that was about rural workers, enslaved people, and then the terms of delivering or contracting labor under freedom. So that paradigm, as you know, with Ira Berlin and people like that, it's still very strong in the literature, although as Marxist models, you can't advance them in their own name anymore, right? You're not allowed to say that that's what you're, that a transition from, you know, to capitalism. You're not, you can't say that anymore. Not exactly sure why, but you can. But one of the things that I think has been really, there's far too little of, is an understanding of how to do women's history that's about labor. And here I'm talking about the South, and I'm talking about agricultural labor. I mean, the literature on, first of all, the literature on the North and the South is incommensurable, mostly in the focus on the home front. I mean, the home front is a misnomer anyway. I wish we could, like, just banish the term. There is no home front in the Confederacy. It's a battlefield, for the most part. It's very permeable boundaries. And home front is a term of denigration to a lot of historians. It's the minor stuff that women historians do when they can't figure out how to write about battles and the army. But really, what happens in the Civil War is that in the Union, there hasn't been enough attention to what goes on in the reorganization of labor in the absence of men to survive the war. Union historians of the Union aren't that, have never been very interested in it because the disruption of the home, of family life and agricultural life and production is much less in the Union than the Confederacy. In the Confederacy, it's always been a major element of the scholarship. I mean, this place has 85% of eligible white men in the army. So there is no normal non-military sphere of life. But at the same time, I think labor historians, you know, the South is an agrarian society. And women's historians who write about, or feminist historians who write about the South during the Civil War, mostly write about elite women and the you know, their attitude towards secession, the meaning of the war for them, their attitude towards slavery. I'm not trying to denigrate this, but the vast majority of white Confederate women, of free Confederate women, were yeoman farmers or poor white women about whom nobody has any interest or any real, I don't think, skills. They don't even know how to do that history. And yet these are people who are left to run these farms with no male labor. Teenage sons are taken off. I mean, male eligibility in the Confederacy was started out as 18 to 35 and ended up 15 to 55. So there's nobody on those farms. Women talk about a countryside stripped of men. And I tried to write about a political crisis in the same sense that Greg's saying, that the labor history and the political history are not separate at all. They completely bleed into one another. And in the Confederacy, I tried to write about what I thought of as a politics of subsistence. You know, what happens when women are left to run these farms with a government that has promised to protect them if they, in the absence of their men, and which they insist that the government deliver. So I do think that's a labor history, but it's not a labor history. It's a labor history I think Herb Gutman would have been fine with. He always had an expansive definition of the worker and of laborer. But I think we need more of it. But I don't think there's actually that much focus on labor in Civil War scholarship, and I don't see it coming either.
Let me address another point that you all raised, and this was about indeed the sort of global history of the Civil War. I have a sense that, for example, in England, there are a number of studies of abolition in the last few years. U.S. abolition, as well as, of course, the abolition movement in England. And do you see any sort of engagement between European and British history, for example, on the subject and U.S. history?
I do, yes. I think so. I think that's what, if you read Chris Brown's recent book on moral capital, I think he's getting to the origins of the British move against the against the slave trade in the 1780s through the context of empire, in which the American Revolution plays the determinative role in precipitating the crisis that allows anti-slavery sentiment that had been there for a long time to transform itself into an anti-slavery movement or an anti-slave trade movement. So he thinks about anti-slavery in imperial terms, global terms, international terms, certainly, in ways that that require the other side of the Atlantic to be there. I think the same is true of the overthrow of colonial slavery by Robin Blackburn, that kind of stuff. I don't think we've begun, by the way, this gets back to the first question that Stephanie asked. I think that 40 years ago, it got into the literature that the relationship between anti-slavery and capitalism meant that anti-slavery is somehow fundamentally a conservative movement. And I think Robin Blackburn's book is a crucial breakthrough away from that. He goes back and he traces the popular origins of it, the radical element in the anti-slavery movement that I think still hasn't penetrated the scholarship. So there is a kind of automatic assumption that because the anti-slavery movement in the United States is associated, correctly I think, with the triumph of capitalism, or a party that is closely associated with the triumph of capitalism, then it's intrinsically a reactionary movement, or it's something fundamentally, irreducibly conservative about it. And I think what Blackburn is pointing us towards is to remind us that there is something left of radicalism in mid-19th century liberal nationalist revolutions, and that the American Civil War partakes of that. And that's what's strongly influencing me. It is precisely that global sense that something, that we've lost the radical element here, that we don't really any longer see the degree, what Marx himself saw, right? You're not supposed to say Marx, right? What Marx himself saw, that there is,
that
structurally, whatever Abraham Lincoln's temperamental conservatism was and his constitutionalism, he is structurally, in Marxist terms, a radical. And what his party represents structurally is a radical transformative movement.
Well, the idea that the American Revolution was the last really progressive bourgeois democratic revolution is an old idea, right?
But this is what
Barrington Moore said in the 60s. But I think that what's new, and what you're saying too, Jim, I think that what's new is that historians are beginning to trace out those transnational connections. That is to say, seeing it kind of in a way, I think that the Spanish Civil War has always been understood as bringing these legions of progressive people to wage this battle, was understood as important to be waged and won. And people came from other Republican and Red Republican movements in other parts of Europe to the United States, formed units in the Civil War to fight on behalf of Lincoln and anti-slavery and the reunification of the United States, because it was understood to be an important international arena of this battle between labor and capital for some people, not all, obviously, in the Union and in the Republican Party. So I think that we've known those things for a long time, but we haven't really traced out the connections. And I think that's the difference between, say, comparative history, where we know that the U.S. war unfolds in this, you know, long history of the, say, you know, bourgeois revolution, and transnational, which actually seeks the connection. People come and they participate and they wage war. I think that the part of the point I was trying to make is that there's a reactionary transnational history too, because slaveholders in Brazil and Cuba paid a great deal of attention to what happened in the United States. And when the Confederacy was finished, you know, racism wasn't over. Certainly the exploitation of labor wasn't over, but it could no longer proceed on those terms. It had to proceed on different terms. And that was an enormously important development. And, you know, I think that that's part of the reason why England and France hesitated to do what they wanted at times to do, which was endorse the Confederacy. Because there was too much hanging on that particular battle. So I think I think that that's what people are going to I can see from book proposals and various things coming up the pipeline, that that's what people are starting to look at.
Actually, you know what else is happening along these lines? the American Revolution is in the history of slavery is beginning to look reactionary. If it's beginning to look like they're afraid of the power of the imperial metropole to start interfering with slavery,
and
a large chunk of the impetus for the American War of Independence is from slaveholders saying, "Do you realize what this represents?"
Well, imagine if they'd stayed in the British Empire.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, the expansion of slavery in the United States all takes place between 1787 and the end of the slave trade, and you know, I mean, if what was it, a 15-year window or something? How many slaves? I think the number of slaves imported to the United States almost doubled in that period. It's
very
astonishing.
It's much more substantial than we used to think.
Yes, it's a huge number.
I mean, as the person who, you know, as someone who emphasized the idea of these sort of transnational global moments, way of views, I feel in a strange position, but of saying that we also need to put a break, not on the impetus to look out, but on the presumption of what transnationalism is going to tell us. And it strikes me that what transnationalism is going to tell us is in part about the exact mapping of the power of the nation. And that if it's set up in opposition to this as to prove the ability to transcend the nation, people will be able, you know, if you send squirrels out to find nuts, they'll find them. You know, people will be able to find examples of it, but it won't actually do us any good. And it strikes me the British example is exactly on point and exactly to the problem of thinking that ideology is what's transnational. In fact, the British Howard Jones's book, which is a sort of strange example of a book that does really connect, despite not being pitched as a book that connects, but to take a sort of, you know, old, standard, maybe even tired, you know, field of diplomatic history and in many ways to branch out into political and to other forms of, not all, but into other forms of history. I think he totally demolishes our sense of what we think England is doing. It turns out that the people who are the most sympathetic to the Confederacy in England are the liberals. The people who are giving trouble to Charles Francis Adams are people like John Bright, are people who are, you know, forged in the anti-slavery movement, and who are the people who are, that we've misunderstood, all kinds of moments in the British reaction. That the Emancipation Proclamation within the Liberal Party in England is greeted with horror. The complaint that is made to the U.S. is that it's going to lead to a slave uprising. And we've assumed a kind of, you know, ideological transnationalism, that people don't be a sort of common position among people with general, political proclivities. But that can only make sense if the nation is irrelevant for how we define our politics. And in fact, it's exactly the opposite, right? That it's a sort of aspect of modern cosmopolitanism that we tell ourselves that we make our politics in relation to some, you know, cosmopolis that we're members of. But that's a lie, right? It's not true. Cosmopolitanism is rooted in a falsehood. In fact, politics is constructed in dialogue with the nation. And in that sense, of the narrowness of English, you know, of English like any people, although I don't think a McCurry is going to complain if I talk about the narrowness of English national interest. Or an Oaks,
or
for that matter.
Add the brutality.
But the narrowness of British, you know, of English self-interest, like every nation's self-interest, of course it structures these people who have nice-sounding words that seem to align, but at those moments, none of that works. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it shows the limits of that as the defining aspect of transnationalism. That the liberals, and it makes sense as we think about the nature of something I know very little about, but what I'm coming to think is the nature of British liberalism, that it's an imperial project. They see this capacity to expand. They want to weaken the United States. And that those are the people who are the most susceptible. The people that the literature sort of reflexively says are the most, and in fact the most, you know, the people in the literature who are the most responsible, repeat over and over that they're the most amenable, that the Union in fact has to proclaim emancipation to gain British liberal support. And in fact, when you look at it, it's exactly the opposite. And so at some level, our ability to think transnationally has to be grounded not just in the sense of what it does, but also when it tells us where that stops. And where that exposes the power of the nation.
One of the things I've learned running this search on transnational modern Europe is that even in the late 19th and early 20th century, very good historians of transnationalism insist that there's an agonistic relationship between the creation of transnational institutions like the unification of Europe or League of Nations or any other kind of supranational body and the inflaming of national loyalties and conflict. I mean, the first age of globalization, as many of these people think of it, the 1880s and 1920s, is also the period of World War I. So there's the people who are thinking in very sharply about this are not proposing a transnational approach in any kind of naive way to diminish the significance of the power of the nation state. Sometimes it actually explains the heightened power of the nation state. But what you're talking about is right. We need a new diplomatic history of the Civil War that's more sort of thinking about geostrategic interests than simply the old, Trent Affair kind of story.
With the time we have left, we should turn over the questions from the audience. If you would come to the microphone.
Hi. I'd like to ask a question as someone who is not a historian at all, and I actually am not very well read on the subject, and I appreciate everything that you guys talked about because it's bringing a really fresh perspective. But as historians, I'm very curious on whether or not, since the general theme I'm getting is that we have missed the mark in terms of really documenting accurately what the causes of the Civil War were and what the aftermath effects were. So as historians, do you feel that because we've missed this mark, as a nation, we have not been able to heal and answer the questions that really need to be answered for us to be a truly unified country because we haven't been able to historically document the actual war and the aftermath?
I mean, I'm a cynic. It may be on this question in particular, growing up in a unionist part of Kentucky that then was full of Confederate flags makes one a cynic, which is to say that I actually think we're pretty powerless. I think it would be pleasing because maybe more broad than that, but certainly historians. I think it would be pleasing because this thing, history exists, and because we're historians, well, managers manage their baseball teams. Why don't historians manage history? But that's never been the case. And it's pleasing to imagine that if we just got it right, then finally people would get it. But I have grave doubts that these falsehoods, I don't think there's any reason to call some of the things that are widely circulated anything prettier than they are, lies. They don't arise out of ignorance. They arise from real bases. And if you don't eliminate the basis of why the lie makes sense, then the truth is impervious to overcome it. I guess in that sense, I think it's we want to get it right because we should. Because we want to do well what we do well, because we want to teach people the types of thinking that allow you to get things right, to think sequentially, to think in terms of arguments, to look at the data. But do I think that if we get it right, that it's going to spill out and people will give up? No, I think their falsehoods are rooted in what they see as their interests and who they think they are. And about those, we are happily or unhappily unable to do much.
Thank you. Excellent answer.
Thank you.
On your theme about scholarship on the Civil War, I couldn't help but notice that in your handout, everyone on your panel today comes from a northern university, whereas on April 5th, it seems that most of the people are coming from southern universities. I don't know if that was deliberate or an accident of circumstances, but it makes me wonder about a question, which is that do you find as historians that even today, in this day and age, that your colleagues in southern universities, particularly the very deep south, do they quite share your views about the nature of the evolving scholarship on the Civil War? Or in fact, are they still, to some degree, do they have a different perspective, or are they under political pressures that exist down there from state governments that fly Confederate flags and alumni that contribute to big universities in the south and administrators, who have their own forces that they have to respond to, as well as more generally the mentality of a Bible Belt population that often has a very hostile view of modernity?
That's an excellent question. There are people who, first of all, there are all kinds of people out there in the public history world who are desperately searching for some certified academic who will say the things they want them to say. And they're always asking, you know, you Yankees are, if just say anything in the New York Times or Washington Post, you're going to get maligned as a Yankee, even if you were born in another country, because your point of view is aligned with this, the academy and the academy of the Ivy Leagues and so forth and so on. But, you know, if you were to ask our peers who are Southerners, they wouldn't really say anything significantly different than us, Ed Ayers or Drew Faust. They wouldn't say anything significantly different. But what I would say is that people who teach in Southern universities, academics, I don't think they have profoundly different views than us, but they have a very different battle. And I have seen this again and again where historians at Southern colleges and even high schools have to fight textbook wars, for example, over what they're being asked to teach. And they have a very different battle. I teach a course on Southern history and the Civil War at the University of Pennsylvania where a lot of Southern kids go. And every year, kids from Richmond tell me, man, that's not what I was taught. And I know that people who teach in the South, including in Southern Mississippi and other places, it's not that they're saying anything profoundly different than us, but they have to go in and dismantle an apparatus that's still in place, courses called the Old South and Moonlight and Magnolias and all this nonsense, and they're still fighting those battles. And they're still fighting battles, you know, it's related to the battles over sports mascots and the flying of the Confederate flag and all of that. So they're just on a different front line in terms of the interface. I think this is what Greg was talking about at the beginning of his remarks, between public history and the endless vitality of neo-Confederate positions outside the academy and all kinds of versions of the academy of people trying to put a stop to that. But there's not enough of us. You can't win. I agree with Greg. We're not going to win that battle. We have to fight it, but I don't think we're naive in thinking we're going to win it.
I would, a friend that Stephanie and I have in common, Brian Simon, taught for years at the University of Georgia, and he would begin his, second half of the survey, begins at the Civil War, and says, Civil War is fought about slavery. And then he would look down at his watch, and then he would look up and see how many people left. At some level, that is not conceivable at City College of New York for all kinds of reasons, right? The other thing, though, they had left already. You look down, they're fast.
The Civil War came out.
There is an interesting question about the lack of Civil War emphasis in New York, the ASHP. As far as I know, the legislature considered and declined to pass any kind of movement to memorialize the war in any way. And I constantly find students who are shocked at the idea that Fernando Wood floats New York seceding from the Union as a ridiculous idea, but they're shocked at the idea that Sven Beckert and other people have really unearthed of how intense the mercantile connections to the South were in New York and how different New York looks than Philadelphia or Boston. But I would also say two quick things to what you said, one of which is there's a difference between where people are from and where they end up working. The president of Harvard, which is the northernmost university, with all deference to Canada, is the northernmost university in the world in some ways, but is a southerner who is a southern historian, and vice versa. Along those lines, I would make one minor qualification to what Stephanie said, which is I am not sure if you traced out. There's a generation of Southerners who came up anxious to define themselves against the neo-Confederate heritage of the past, and in that sense seemed to fit well, of which I would say both Ayers and Ed Ayers, the president of the University of Richmond, an extremely distinguished historian, and Drew Faust, the president of Harvard University, both came out of. And yet there is also, particularly perhaps for that generation, an ambiguity about what they saw as the opposite side of that, the celebration of the North. And with that, I do think you can define as a Southern trait, going from Woodward, the greatest of American historians, through Ayers, through Faust, which is of a Southern liberal position that begins as a critique of Southern reactionaries and ends as a critique of Northern liberals. And this strikes me as entirely within the world of experience, even that I and a younger generation experienced in Central Kentucky and Middle Tennessee. That it's entirely within the tone of how liberal people are amalgamated to think about it.
I think that's right. I think there is a
there is a weak but real correlation between, I think there is a generation of Southern liberals historians who absolutely accept that the reason the South seceded was to defend slavery, and they will say so. They're not so willing to accept that the reason the North went to war had anything to do with anti-slavery. And that's where I think the division can have some sectional basis. Not hard and fast, because there is something to the idea that there is an academic community in which we talk among ourselves certain ways that are familiar to ourselves and that are different from the way Tea Party people talk about American history.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm talking particularly to Dr. Oakes here. So you were saying, you were painting a narrative of the Union before the war, or at the very beginning of the war, and continuing on through the Emancipation Proclamation, as a region full of people who were in some way fighting against slavery, and that being a major cause of the Union's involvement in the war. I'm
speaking specifically, and I'm very careful about it, about the Republican Party. I think the North is bitterly, bitterly divided over this issue. Republicans are in the driver's seat at that particular moment, for the reason we have a civil war. But there's a very strong Democratic Party. You know, I think the counterpart to the kind of social upheaval and conflict that Stephanie and others trace in the South is there in the North. It manifests itself differently. It has different social bases. It comes out differently. But there are draft riots in the North. There is Copperheadism in the North. There's a great deal of opposition to what the Republicans are doing in the North. So I wouldn't want to say the North does this. I'm careful not to say the North.
Okay, that was my first question. And I guess the addendum to that, or what I was going to continue and ask you, was, so you then continue to talk about neo-revisionism, or what you've termed neo-revisionism, and the idea that people have attempted to complicate the issue of, you know, the South had slavery, the North did not, with the idea, well, but the North was racist too. And I'm very concerned about what I'm seeing as a separation between the issue of slavery and the issue of race, because I don't see them as separate, and I think it's important to acknowledge that the North was racist too, and I really don't think that it simplifies the argument in any way to say that, you know, well, the South had slavery, but the North was racist too, is revisionism. Do you understand what I'm saying?
But it was you could agree or you just disagree with it, but it is it was a critical move in the original revisionist narrative to shift the terms of debate. And it does grow out of the Democratic Party's position, anti-Republican position, to try to shift the terms of debate to the question of racial equality when the Republicans wanted it to be kept on the question of slavery. It's not that the two aren't related, it's that they aren't the same. Mm-hmm. I have brothers and sisters that I'm related to, but I'm not my brother and I'm not my sister. They are related. And how they are related is very interesting and very important, in fact, crucial to understand the relationship between race and slavery. But they are not the same thing. That is, a society that says black kids go to a school that's different from white kids is not the same as a society that says black kids are property and it's illegal to teach them how to read. There is a racist element in both societies, but property in human beings is not the same thing that's going on in the North. It's not racial discrimination. Slavery is one thing, racial discrimination is something else. Understanding the relationship between the two is an interesting and important thing. But be careful about the race question is also prone to the kind of consensus language that we get when we try to collapse the distinction between the North and South using race. We do it all the time. We would, 50 years ago after World War II, when we saw this, the Americans thing, you know, it's very hard for historians used to write about the American mind. And then we realized you're not supposed to talk about that that way. There is no such thing as the American mind. But people have no qualms about talking about the white mind. People write all the time about the white mind, whites this, white that, as though there were no conflict. Right? There is conflict over race in the North, just as there is conflict over slavery in the North. And that conflict is also there going on at the same time that the Civil War is going on. And I don't think we've begun to differentiate those and see what the difference, what the relationship between those conflicts is. I'm only saying don't collapse the distinction by using those tropes like the North had, the South had slavery and the North was racist too, because it's a gesture that ends up making the Civil War make no sense. It makes it impossible to understand why people would be fighting over slavery at that particular moment.
Well, also, there's probably fewer distinctions that mattered more to African Americans who were enslaved in the 19th century than the distinction between an anti-slavery racist and a pro-slavery racist.
Thank you.
So my question is for Professor Oakes. I really enjoyed your sort of talk and this whole idea of this move from emancipation to abolition, and I'm also sort of really curious about the ways in which you found all this research that unearthed the fact that all these congressmen and these different people were talking about emancipation long before it actually gets solidified with Lincoln's proclamation. But I guess my concern is that that move sort of evacuates freed people from the discussion and the intervention in some way that I think that the Barber
freed people.
And yeah, in terms of what I think that, I mean, one of the things that I think that the Freedmen's and Southern Society Project did in terms of an intervention was it was to sort of argue that the term contraband, as Barbara Fields would argue, left the term unsettled, whether people were free or not. And in those contraband camps, in the Sea Islands that you described, outside of Washington, D.C., and Alexandria, and so forth, those people didn't have a right to leave. And so that it may have been sort of emancipation in this sort of understanding that you formulated, that they're not under chattel slavery, but they're still refugees and prisoners. And so I think that I don't want to get rid of the earlier historiography that has really problematized the fact that these people were in a situation where they didn't have movement, movement that only would be licensed through the Emancipation Proclamation. I mean, my sense is that when I went over through, I mean, when I went through the documents on this in the Treasury Department and so forth, the only way they're getting into the camps and they're getting it is if they're willing to work. So it's emancipation from chattel slavery, but the term contraband, in my estimation, works so much better in terms of recognizing their political and social status. So I recognize that your project is more invested in talking about the sort of political history of what emancipation means and the sort of ways in which these ideas have sort of percolated within Congress and so forth. But my concern is, I'll just say my question. My question is, what is the ramification then for freed slaves, for people that have liberated slaves, ex-slaves, the 19th century parlance, contraband, refugee, whatever you want to call it, what does it mean for them on the ground?
Well, I said early on that in my talk, it's telescoping of a gigantic issue, that the history of emancipation has a lot of aftermaths to it, but not much in the way of origins. I think emancipation raises huge questions, ongoing questions, about what it means to be free, and that's partly what you're talking about there. I'm using the language, in some sense, of what the people at the time are using. That is, Chase says they're free. He doesn't say they're contraband. He says they're free. I think the issue of labor mobility, for example, one of the ways you can, I didn't talk about this, I only talked about the language, but one of the things, if you look at what's going on the ground in the Sea Islands, those teachers and those people and supervisors down there are complaining all the time that they can't stop the freed people, the contrabands, whatever, on the plantation from going off to the Union Army to work for them because the wages are surer and better, stuff like that. They're clearly complaining about the fact of mobility, of labor mobility that they can no longer control. And they're sending the kids, and they're setting up schools for the kids. And there's no slave market. And the marriages are being formally recognized and stuff like that. The attributes of freedom are there. What freedom is going to mean, how free is free, is a big, giant question. And one of the things I'm trying to do is to cut off the history of how you get to free from the question of what happens afterwards, because they are coeval, they lead next to one another directly. Because emancipation happens early, those questions arise early during the war, but they are aftermath questions. Right? They arise because they are free. Right? And I think there is a, I don't have any problem with, as far as, there, I thought you were going to ask a different question about it. There is a question about the agency. Right? It's not a question of whether the slaves freed themselves or anything like that. One of the things that's been most amazing to me is the degree to which the Republicans knew what we're all so proud of having figured out. Right? That everything they think about how emancipation is going to happen depends for them on slaves running to Union lines, claiming their freedom. They're assuming that's going to happen. They're hoping that's going to happen. When you read the newspaper reports of what happened, of the contraband stuff at Fortress Monroe, the language in it is, now we see the fulfillment of the prophecies, right? Because one of the debates between Democrats and Republicans during the secession crisis about emancipation, and then there's a huge nationwide debate over emancipation and slavery during the secession crisis, is the Republicans are saying, just wait. When the Union Army goes down there, the slaves are going to run to Union lines, they're going to claim their freedom, and there's nothing you're going to be able to do to stop that, right? When it happens at Fortress Monroe, the newspaper reports say, you see, we're vindicated. They are doing exactly what they said. All of their assumptions about how emancipation on the ground is going to happen depended on the agency of the slaves. I'm not saying that the slaves don't participate in their own emancipation. I'm saying we know that, but so did they.
Two more questions.
Thank you. My name is Bob Martin, and my question is directed to the panel at large. I wanted to revisit Herb Gutman and his preoccupation with the working class and the working class as a distinct, discrete group. And I'd like to add a sort of comparative element to it. I wanted to get some feedback from you to get your thoughts on whether or not the institution of slavery itself and the whether or not that you think has impacted the absence of the development of a cohesive working class in working class in the United States that would say produce a Labor Party European style, whether or not you think slavery itself distorted the labor market in such a structural and fundamental way that it adversely affected the opportunity for the development of a cohesive working class and a strong working class movement in the United States, and whether or not ultimately it was a triumph of neoliberal capitalism by not having such a movement compared to, say, the Europeans, Britain, France, and the others.
Well, I'll throw in something. I clearly, there's an impact. I think what's quite striking, and you see this particularly in the post-Civil War labor movement, the Knights of Labor, for example, or for that matter, even things like the United Mine Workers in the late 19th century, surprising and fascinating alliances. To be sure, often in the way that Jim described it, often observing segregation, yet at the same time inclusive, except for, of course, fascinatingly, the Chinese, which is a whole other racial issue in the late 19th century. But, I think that the notion of opportunities that come out of, or the supposed end of Reconstruction, in the sense of in many ways, interracial organizing in late 19th century labor movement has been way underestimated.
I'm really struck, I mean, I know this is an incredibly presentist observation, but it's not that I would deny what you're saying, that we would have to think through very carefully the impact of slavery and especially post-slavery labor relations on the political consolidation of a powerful working class party in the United States. But it seems like the crucial developments are in the late 19th century and the early 20th century. And I have to say that sitting in this moment now, I'm really reminded of how much the working class was up against in the United States. And when I think about Britain, I mean, I grew up in Northern Ireland, and I think about the language of class that just permeates everything and the power of the Labour Party. It doesn't seem to me that those explanations that are about race, you know, that it was too divisive of a force, this is all true. But I think the greater issue has to do with the power of capital. And why am I thinking about that now? Because the only part of the economy that seems to function is the part that in New York voted for secession in 1860, that, you know, Fernando Wood represented. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's not, it certainly isn't a very reliable basis for a historical judgment, but it certainly seems to me that the question isn't simply the consequences of slavery on the ability of American workers to see beyond the history of slavery and race and form a coherent party, but rather the power of capital in the United States, which was it matched anywhere? I don't know.
Thank you.
Without too much extremely undeserved, good word for the capitalists, I will say that when Wood says that the people who bring him back into the fold are the August Belmont, who's the Rothschilds representative in the United States, the Browns are these major bond issuers who say, "Are you nuts? If we leave the U.S., then we're not going to get, they're going to issue more bonds than any, you know, than any country in history, and we're going to get shut out of it." And it is the bond issuers who actually go to Wood and say, "That's got to end. You can, you know, talk trash about Lincoln." But we're in, and in fact, Lincoln rewards them directly by funneling an enormous amount of the, sure, of the $3 billion of bonds through New York City.
Well, so the financiers come around. the cotton merchants, not so much.
I don't want to end this on contentions, and I have a lot of sympathy for Professor Oakes's position, but I'm wondering about the legal side of it. I see you sort of eliding the category of manumission and emancipation. Emancipation is usually a state act, and manumission is the act of individuals. And I also think about the analogy of land. I mean, in the same way that the army and agents of the federal government freed, as you would say, it, slaves during the Civil War, they also seized land for all sorts of purposes during the Civil War. Right. But very few people other than the original owners got titled to it. And in fact, very quickly, there was an initial presidential pardon and then a series of presidential pardons. And so I have trouble appreciating your argument that the Union was all for emancipation, that it would have been sufficient to let it ride on a presidential proclamation and not have it ride in a constitutional amendement, because maybe I misunderstood your position.
Yeah, I'm trying to say exactly the opposite. The proclamation was not enough. But let me go to your, I think you have hit on one of the central problems of explaining the origins of emancipation, and that has to do with the nature of, capitalist development. I think something fundamental happens to the nature of property and property law in the United States as capitalism develops in the 19th century, that a proliferation of different kinds of property allows Northerners to begin imagining treating different kinds of property differently instead of being in a society where all the wealth is landed, right? You start getting all sorts of liquid wealth, movable wealth, right? And from that, if you want to call it base, anti-slavery people begin to make a fundamental argument for differentiating slave property legally and constitutionally from other forms of property. The origins of the distinction you're talking about, which I think is critical, is that they go into the war saying, we have no power. We have very limited power to expropriate and confiscate land and real estate, because the Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, puts very strict limits on what we're allowed to do to take land beyond the life of the owner. But they have come through 30, 40 years of building a very strong argument that the Constitution differentiates slaves slave property from that. It does the restrictions in the Constitution do not apply to slave property the way they apply to landed property. So the very same argument that is an awful lot of they have to put. It's in a sense, it's a shame they ended up having to do this. But the slaves are property under local law, not protected by the Constitution. So while we confiscate property, it is not confiscatable beyond the life of the owner, except under very severe restrictions, whereas slave property is not constitutionally protected. Therefore, when we confiscate it, we can legally then emancipate the slave, and the owner has no claim to it beyond from that point on. I think you have to understand the way they're thinking about property, and I think that goes back to what happens to property in capitalist developments and things like that, and the difference between the way the South is in a peculiar way. I never thought I'd say this. Static, stuck in the 18th century, not in Middle Ages, but in the 18th century, in a notion where property is more absolute than it becomes over the course of the 19th century. That's why I think it's astonishing to me how many historians don't read the central argument of Lincoln's Cooper Union Address. The central argument he's making is that the Constitution does not recognize slaves as property the way it recognizes other forms of property.
If you keep going in this line of argument, what you're effectively doing is proving that the radical secessionists were right.
Yes.
That everything they said that Lincoln threatened was in fact the case.
I think that's right.
Just wanted to be clear.
I think that's right. I think it's a mistake to treat the secessionists as hysterical. I think if you look at what the secessionists are saying, the secessionist speeches, the secessionist editorials, they read each other carefully. They are being very precise about what they're saying is going on. And they know what the other is threatening to do, and they are absolutely right about it. There is nothing they can do to stop this. The conflict really is fundamentally irreconcilable at that point to me. It's not about hysteria. It's about a fundamental irreconcilable difference.
Okay. Well, thank you for those questions, and thank you for the panel.